Gegen den Klimawandel unternimmt niemand etwas. Wer hat, dem wird gegeben werden. Und Frauen verdienen weniger. War ja immer schon so. Man ärgert sich und macht weiter. Was aber, wenn nicht? Wir haben eine Idee. Die Falter Arena macht die Bühne frei für Menschen und Projekte, die das Land verändern. Mein Name ist Eva Konzett. Ich leite das Politikressort im Falter. Und am Sonntag, den 26. Mai, veranstalten wir im Wiener Stadtsaal die nächste Falter Arena. Mit dabei unter anderem der ehemalige Politiker und Neosänger Matthias Strolz, Theresa Imre von Magda, Sonja Jöchtl von Love Politics oder Kari Ochsner von Ochsner Wärmepumpen. Machen statt jammern. Wir schauen uns an, wie das funktionieren kann. Kommen auch Sie vorbei. Alle Informationen und Tickets finden Sie unter falter.at/arena.
Falter-Podcasts werden durch Werbung unterstützt. Das hilft bei der Finanzierung unseres journalistischen Angebots.
Hereinspaziert durch unser Burgtor. Ob Burgherr, Ritterin, Stallbursche oder Gauklerin. Die Burg Liechtenstein in Maria Enzersdorf bei Wien lädt zu Erkundungen ein und weckt bei Groß und Klein die Abenteuerlust. Erbaut im Jahr 1130, ist die Burg bis heute zu 60% im Originalzustand erhalten. Waffenkammer, Turmzimmer und Ritterstube. Die Stammburg der Fürstenfamilie von und zu Liechtenstein bietet Einblicke in das Leben im Mittelalter. Besuchen Sie uns jetzt in der Erlebniswelt Burg Liechtenstein. Jeden Sonntag mit eigener Kinderführung. www.burglichtenstein.eu.
Falter Radio, der Podcast mit Raimund Löw.
Sehr herzlich willkommen, meine Damen und Herren, im Falter Radio. Diese Sendung bietet Ihnen eine russische Innenansicht auf Putins Krieg gegen die Ukraine. Der ursprüngliche Plan, Kiew innerhalb weniger Tage einzunehmen und an die Stelle von Präsident Zelensky eine Marionette des Kreml einzusetzen, ist gescheitert. Seit dem Herbst müssen die russischen Besatzer besetzte Gebiete dem ukrainischen Militär überlassen. Dann kam die Teilmobilmachung, mit deren Hilfe die russische Generalität die eigenen Streitkräfte verstärken will. Gleichzeitig kam der formelle Anschluss mehrerer ukrainischer Provinzen an Russland durch Putin, eine weitere gefährliche Eskalation, die für einen möglichen zukünftigen Waffenstillstand eine schwere Hürde sein wird. Dazu kommen die wiederholten Drohungen mit Atomwaffen aus Moskau. Die explosive Gemengenlage analysiert der russische Investigativjournalist Andrei Soldatov in einem Gespräch mit Misha Kleine, das auf Englisch geführt wurde. Soldatov lebt im Exil. Er ist einer der besten Kenner der russischen Geheimdienste und des Machtkartells im Kreml. Misha Kleine fragt Soldatov zu Beginn, wie er die Situation für Wladimir Putin in diesem Herbst einschätzt.
If we look at the dynamics of the moment, he seems to be confident that the Russian people are either prepared to go along with what's happening or are actually keen to back him. Have there been any signs? We saw just a couple of weeks ago the meeting in Samarkand, Uzbekistan. We saw what was obviously serious criticism by the Chinese president, Xi Jinping, regarding the course of the war in Ukraine. We saw clear snubs by Central Asian leaders towards Putin. He no longer controls the peace process in between Azerbaijan and Armenia. There's a war that's broken out between Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan. So clearly he's losing control, or his influence is diminishing there. There was the seeming unrest in Dagestan around the mobilization, and there was some internal criticism, notably in the councillors in St. Petersburg and a Moscow. And yet his response to all of this, along with the military defeats in Kharkiv, his response to all of this appears to be to double down. Is that because he's frightened, or is it because he is confident, notwithstanding all these events?
I think he's extremely angry. I don't think he's losing touch with reality. I don't think so. He seemed very confident, and he is, unfortunately, he's not insane, but he's extremely angry. So his way to reestablish control and to remind everybody, at least in the country, who is in control, is to start with mobilization. Because, of course, mobilization is not only about getting people to the front line. It's also about how to make everybody think that nobody is safe anymore in the country. And we talk about people in their 20s, in their 40s, in their 60s. We have people mobilized in their 60s. So it looks like a complete mess. But unfortunately, it also has this intimidation effect on people. Because right now, people cannot think of a bigger picture. What they think now, they're forced to think. They need to think about their immediate problems, immediate circumstances, about their relatives, about their friends, how to get them out of the country. The good question is, for how long would you want to have this happening? I mean, this mobilization, well, at least at this stage. If, say, he would finish tomorrow, what would happen with the Russian public opinion? Because it looks like the very first victim of his mobilization is his control over the information space in the country. We all believed for years that he stayed in power for so long because people, the Russian population, well, watched his television, and it was under complete control. Putin also had built a really big system of internet censorship, and now it completely collapsed. This system was built back in 2018, 2019, with the idea to suppress traffic from regions if something is happening in the regions, and to address specifically a problem of video, because video is likely to provoke more emotional reaction and possibly unrest or revolution than, say, text. And that's exactly what is going on right now. We have all these videos coming from the regions, and the biggest problem of the Russian internet censorship now is they cannot cope with the sheer size of the crisis. So that thing already collapsed. We have people in villages and small towns, not only in St. Petersburg and Moscow, watching nervously all these videos, trying to understand what to do, where to go, and they cannot trust Russian television. And it already has an effect on the Russian television. Russian TV hosts are getting more critical because they understand that they are losing trust of the Russian audience. So they need to say something about mobilization. And in these circumstances, I think it's a very new development for Putin. It's a very new situation. He never faced this before.
Andrei, this is a really fascinating insight of yours, which hadn't occurred to me before, that he is losing control of his monopoly over information, which has been so important for him for so long. If we think back to Afghanistan and the motivation for the end to the invasion and occupation of Afghanistan, one of the key reasons for that was the so-called mothers movement, of the fact that they were getting unhappy about their children being killed and with no explanation and so on and so forth. If you're correct on this idea of he's losing control of the monopoly of the media, and you have, I would say, a significant greater number of casualties coming from Ukraine that you had out of Afghanistan, surely wouldn't this amount to an existential threat to Putin's strategy? Or are they still too frightened? I mean, what can we tease this out a bit as to why we don't see, apart from in limited areas like Dagestan with its specific issues, we don't see a greater spread of protest? Or is it happening and we're just not seeing it?
Well, unfortunately, I think it's not that optimistic. What is different from what we saw back in the 1980s with the war in Afghanistan is that these new movements like Soldiers' Mothers and all that, they were allowed by the authorities, by Gorbachev. So it was a sanctioned civic activity. And the repressive apparatus of the Soviet Union was, of course, extremely large. But it's not comparison with what we have now. The other interesting thing is that the war in Afghanistan didn't affect the Soviet security services. We had some developments inside. For instance, the KGB formed the special forces groups again to operate in Afghanistan. But what we see now with Ukraine, we see a complete and titanic reshuffle of the Russian security services. And if before the war we compared the FSB, the major Russian security service, to the KGB, these days we need to compare it with something much darker, with Stalin's secret services, especially the way the military counterintelligence operates in the occupied territories. All these filtration camps, that tradition comes from the late 1940s. What we saw in Western Ukraine, in Eastern Europe, it's a very traditional thing for Stalin's secret services. So they are getting much more brutal, much more militarized than what we had back in the 1980s. The amount of repressions we can see, and we already see, and the brutality reminds me of what happened 2 years ago in Belarus. Just last week, we got a guy, a poet in Moscow, who had his apartment raided by police, and he was raped in his apartment. And his girlfriend was forced to watch it. They'd never seen that before. So that's how things are developing. And my biggest problem with the optimism is, unfortunately, when you see this kind of brutality, it might be really difficult to try to build some grassroots movement and to get something out of these protests we have now. Still, there are some options, of course. We all understand Dagestan is a very, very difficult region to control. All the terrorist attacks we had in, not all of them, but most of them we had in the late 2000s and 2010s, that was Dagestan. So it's a very difficult region. They have problems with neighbors. And if, say, Putin decides to send some Chechens in to suppress revolt, well, that might start as a big problem between these two regions. But unfortunately, it's a far cry from a revolution in Moscow.
And what about the concept of the so-called Ceausescu moment? One could call it the Ceausescu moment or the Milosevic moment, where parts of his relatively close elite and security forces decide that he is becoming a liability to their interests. Are there any signs that that might be a possible trajectory, or are they completely subordinate to his will, as far as we can tell?
Well, first of all, Russian security services are very unlike what, say, Egypt has, or Syria, Turkey. There was never a really big underground movement in Russian or Soviet security services. They did not know how to do that. They also have a problem of trust. Remember that in 1991, when the putsch failed in Moscow, it failed not because of all the Moscovites who came to the streets and protested, but because rank and file of the KGB failed to support the leadership of the KGB. And they still have this problem. They do not know how to build trust within the FSB. They're quite suspicious of each other. They also do not know how to distribute properly all the money they have access to. It's not like Egypt, and that is why like officers like majors and colonels, they do not trust and they actually hate their generals. It's not actually the ground you want to have if you want to start building a coup. The other problem is that if you want to do something like a coup, you need some political support. And we had this in the 1990s. Some governors were against Yeltsin, some political parties we had back then, even the Communist Party was quite, I would say they probably would support something like that. And also you need to have some popular generals. What Putin has been doing all these months, he was making sure that this war would not produce popular generals. We don't know the names of people who actually run this war. We have Minister Shoigu, who has no military background, no military training. He's not respected within the military. We also have the chief of the general staff, who is a bit more respected, but he's not, I would say, a guy who would be acting independently.
Gerasimov,
yes. But we do not know the names of the people who are on the battlefield. And that is, well, I would say, a very systematic effort from the Kremlin.
So we saw at the beginning of the invasion that it didn't go the way that that Putin intended. It's agreed upon fairly widely that he had believed in the 4 to 5 day taking of Kyiv, and then the Zelensky government would collapse and so on. So this must have been a huge shock, not just to Putin, but to a lot of people in Russia, that the invincible Red Army was not as invincible as they all thought. Indeed, it turned out to be hugely incompetent in many ways. So given that, and the mobilization, are we now assuming that Putin's fundamental strategy is just to throw hundreds of thousands, even millions of men into the meat grinder of Ukraine? Is that the fundamental military strategy he's left with, or are there other options?
Well, the interesting thing that, yes, he had this plan before February 24th. And the most interesting thing for me is that he failed to change this plan for almost 7 months. For all these months, basically what we saw the same plan just being patched with some add-on elements, but it was basically the same thing. And he's still calling it a special military operation, and not only for propaganda reasons, because actually he believed in this idea. But what, unfortunately, is the feeling in the country, and it benefits Putin, is that it's so humiliating to feel that you are getting defeated by the Ukrainians, that this idea is not accepted by the society. Instead, what you have a big idea that we went into this war, but actually it is not a war with Ukraine, it is a war with the West. And because it's such a big thing, you have the whole of the West against one country, so it doesn't matter how many casualties you have, because you have the entire world against you. And as Putin said in his speech, yesterday, that has been the case all these centuries. We always had this country surrounded by enemies, attacking it from every angle. And that is why we need to get ready to sustain more casualties. And to a large extent, people accept that. The interesting thing that also you have, of course, the military pushing Putin, saying, look, you made us look a fool to attack in Ukraine with such a small number of people. Now the Ukrainians are superior, not only in terms of technology supplied by the West, but also in terms of numbers. We just cannot fight this way. We need people, which is actually, which makes some sense, militarily speaking. So you have some support in the society, and you have also support in the military. The most pessimistic thing is that we all see these pictures and videos that the people they mobilize, they are not professional, they are not competent, they are not trained properly. And we think that it's a sign of desperation and collapse. It is not. What the Russian military think they still have really capable units, but being completely misused because they lack ordinary infantry units. So they do not ask for more professional units. They need just people, just to hold the line. And they believe that when they get these people, they can finally use properly the Spetsnaz forces, VDV forces, all these professional units they still have. So for a time being, I would say all these disastrous pictures, putting aside, the military are quite okay with what is going on.
Right. So the implications of what you're saying is we are in for many, many more months, if not years, of war, because the successes of Ukraine in the north militarily are likely to be temporary, in as much that the military will now have the manpower, the Russian military, it has been asking for, in order to hold the line and possibly push back the Ukrainian army again?
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Yeah, I fear that it could be the most possible scenario, unfortunately.
And what about the issue of the possible deployment of a nuclear weapon? Do you think that this is Putin merely trying to unsettle the West? Or is he actually trying to indicate to the United States and Europe that he is actively considering a deployment of a nuclear weapon?
I think the most dangerous thing here is that Putin believes that he has a plan, and that is why he is in control. But actually, he's not, and he doesn't understand that. Last week, we saw a lot of pro-Kremlin, pro-war journalists and propagandists sharing one particular video. It was made in August 2014, and there was Vladimir Zhirinovsky, who was a kind of a Russian version of Trump, making a speech in presence of Putin that we need to recruit prisoners and send them to war in Ukraine. And Putin was laughing. And it was clear from the footage, from this video, that Putin thought this idea was absolutely like a crazy idea. And Zhirinovsky was seen as a clown in the Russian politics. But now these days, all these war correspondents, they think it was a great idea. And Zhirinovsky was actually right. But what is terrifying to me is just to think that 8 years ago, in 2014, Vladimir Putin thought that something was absolutely unthinkable, and now he's doing exactly that. We have people recruited in prisons. That means that there is no plan in his mind. He's always tactical. And that means that if some circumstances would be not really good for him, he might come up with some other idea, some new idea. Okay, maybe to do that, maybe to do this. And this mobilization might be, well, if, say, the military tomorrow say, no, it's not enough. Again, that is the problem with a guy who always thinks tactically.
I want to talk about something which isn't discussed very often, partly because we're still deep in the middle of this war. But if we look forward to when the war has finished, regardless of how it's finished, how do other countries in Central Europe, in Western Europe, in the United States, how do these countries engage with Russia? Because Russia, whatever the outcome of this war is, will still have almost half the world's stockpile of nuclear weapons. So you're dealing with a country and a society where the rules are basically different for that one fundamental reason, if nothing else. How do you see the future of Russia and its engagement with the West after this is over?
Of course, we all see this big push for isolation. And I absolutely understand the emotions here that, of course, some might think it's just would be better just to close the door. But unfortunately, it cannot be done. You have 140 million people there. It's a big country. It's always will be there. So there should be some strategy, some idea accepted by many countries, first of all, in Europe, what to do with this country. And I think we all should understand, even if it's very emotionally difficult, that we need to re-engage Russia. It's impossible to isolate it completely. And I still believe that we still have lots of good people outside of the country, but also inside. They feel absolutely... I understand the sufferings of Ukrainians are up, but just not comparison to what the Russians are facing with. But just imagine the country, and maybe it's good to talk about this thing here in Austria. Just imagine a country where you have the thinking part of the society feeling completely lost because the past of the country, the history of Russia, now feels to us completely compromised because of all these imperial exploits, all the horrible things which were done by the Russian Empire in the 18th century, in the 19th century, the way we think about the Russian Empire. The Russian present, well, feels absolutely horrible, but also the future. So we have no standing, not in our past, not in our present, not in our future. We feel completely, completely confused. That is why we have some Russians thinking that we need to rethink completely everything about Russian, for instance, about Russian flag. This is a sign of desperation because nobody understands what to do, how to think about your country. The problem here is that if so many people get confused, it's easier for some populist to give them some idea that, look, nobody loves you, and okay, so we understand what comes next.
Do you think that the way the West, and NATO countries in particular, has approached and responded to the Russian invasion of Ukraine is the right response? Is it going in the right direction? And are you confident that it would, if that is so, that it will be able to maintain that direction itself domestically, internally, as it were?
I think that the military strategy providing military help to Ukraine, I think it was absolutely right, and it is the right strategy. And what we all need to find and help to do is to help Ukraine to win this war. That's absolutely clear. What to do next and how to re-engage, how to talk to these people, how to talk to the country, it's a different matter. Because not only the Russians feel completely confused, everybody gets completely confused. I mean, I just went back from the States, almost in every big university in the States, you have some people who are experts and in Russian studies, and all of them are confused because so many things now look completely different with this new perspective. Just, well, we don't know what to think about the Second World War anymore. We used to believe that, well, the Soviet troops did horrible things, but still they were on the right side of the history. And that sort of justified many things afterwards. Not anymore. And so the whole idea, the whole concept, how we see the country, just collapsed. Again, not only for the Russians, but also for people in the West. I think it would take years to find a way. And I don't think that anybody has an answer right now.
Andrei, I don't think I've ever had a conversation with you in which you've sounded as despondent, if I can put it like that, as you are this afternoon. And I wonder whether if you, with your insights, with your network in the West and inside Russia, if you're feeling despondent, how do ordinary Russians, let's say the Russian diaspora in Europe at the moment, feel about their existence? Because obviously the sympathy for the Ukraine is understandably very, very high. Are we seeing a sort of collective trauma amongst Russians as well that we aren't perhaps able to identify quite as easily as the obvious trauma that Ukrainians are suffering?
Yes, absolutely. In the beginning of the war, when we got so many people out of the country, when we got this first wave of emigration, there were lots of conversations among Russian emigres that we need to find a way how to have a conversation about the future of the country. And for that, we need to have some institutions, maybe some sort of Russian university in exile. And of course, now, with the war getting more and more ugly, this kind of prospect seems to be very distant. The other problem is that the Russians also, all the time, hear this very emotional argument, not only from the Ukrainians, but also from people rightly outraged by what the Russians are doing in Ukraine, that maybe it's time for you to shut up. We hear you for too long. And it's not, we don't care about what you say and what you talk about. The problem is that you just cannot produce a new narrative for your country if you are not talking about it, right? So we still need to have this conversation. And this conversation should be not only within the Russian community, it should be also with the world. We do not want to strengthen this myth of the country being absolutely unique. That's what Putin knows how to exploit. And to be honest, it's such a big thing. Even now, I know from my conversations with my friends, that if you have anyone trying to find some historical comparisons, it's always about the Russian past. It's never about other countries' experiences. We always talk, if we talk about the prospects of the revolution, we always talk about 1917. We never talk about the revolutions in other countries. Never, ever. If we talk about the protest, again, it's about 2011, 2012. We do not talk about the Arab Spring. We don't have this in our experience. And I think it's part of the problem. Because if you have this idea that this country was always unique, it makes all other lessons being absolutely inapplicable to Russia. It looks like this country is just doomed. You cannot do anything with it. I mean, it's not, well, you know all these arguments. This country never seen any democracy ever. They were always like that, so let's stay them this way. Unfortunately, we live on one planet, and we need to find a way how to re-engage all the countries in the world, including Russia.
Sie hörten ein Gespräch des russischen Investigativjournalisten Andrei Soldatov mit Misha Glenny, dem Rektor des Instituts für die Wissenschaften von Menschen, vom 1.10.2022 in Wien. Die Veranstaltung mit Soldatov fand im Rahmen des Humanity Festivals statt. Ich bedanke mich sehr herzlich bei den Veranstaltern für die Zusammenarbeit. Ich verabschiede mich von allen, die uns auf UKW folgen, im Freirad Tirol und auf Radio Agora in Kärnten. Analysen und Berichte zum russischen Ukraine-Krieg gibt es regelmäßig im Falter. Alle Informationen, wie Sie den Falter abonnieren können und was für Möglichkeiten es für gratis Probeabos gibt, finden Sie unter der Adresse abo.falter.at. Ursula Winterauer hat die Signation gestaltet, Philipp Dietrich betreut die Audiotechnik im Falter. Ich verabschiede mich bis zur nächsten Folge.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue checkmark next to that thing you love. And be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.